Movie Buff Specialist Phil and John are back as we continue counting down our favorite 100 movies of all time. Interesting episode ahead today as we hit number 36 on our list, which is The Usual Suspects for me and The Fellowship of the Ring for John. However, we're not talking about The Fellowship of the Ring. We're talking about a movie that John is using to replace it, but that John is acknowledging would also be higher than Fellowship of the Ring had he seen this beforehand, and that is Seven Samurai. First time I watched it was this week. I did have to take four naps in between, take a full 8 hours of rest afterwards. I sure was tired, but 3 hours and 27 minutes. It uses every minute wisely. But anyway, so two very different kinds of movies. Can't wait to talk about The Usual Suspects. I know, John, you'd already known the twist. Anybody who's listening to this, if you don't know the twist, stop listening. We're going to start with The Usual Suspects, and then we're going to talk about Seven Samurai. Mainly because you have Seven Samurai replacing Fellowship of the Ring, and I think it's an interesting idea to look at this. Mm-hmm. And the Fellowship of the Ring is always going to be one of the most popular movies ever made. But, John, this was your first time watching The Usual Suspects. I have my reasons for why it's on my list. I am also acknowledging right now that this movie suffers from the weight of its own success. Big time. Mm-hmm. Big time, big time, big time. This movie will drop on my list pretty significantly. This week I watched Paths of Glory, and after watching that, I was like, oh, I need to update like where things are at in my top 100, everything like that. And currently in this moment, I have The Usual Suspects all the way back at number 71. So nearly double where it was here. However, I pretty much do this every time I watch The Usual Suspects. So I'm just prefacing with that. But John, this was your first time watching it. I know you texted me throughout at certain points to be like, Phil, it's pretty obvious. What did you think? Because then I'm going to give my speech on why this movie no longer works, not from the standpoint of that it's not great, but why new people cannot actually sit down and enjoy this movie. So go.
So, like you said, this is the first time I've ever seen Usual Suspects, but I mean, this movie's, what, 27 years old now? Nope, longer. No, that's right, right? It's 27 years old. Yeah. At this point, it's almost impossible to go into this movie without knowing this twist. And because of that, myself as a new viewer going into this movie, I'm just watching it and it's like, how did people not pick up on this? Like, I felt it was incredibly obvious. Now, of course, I know to kind of be looking for those type of things that are hinting at this big twist reveal at the end. But I felt that some of it was just so obvious that it couldn't really be ignored if you knew to be looking at it. And I think that's where my issue with the film went. I will never deny that this is a good film. This is a very good film. Kevin Spacey's performance is incredible as Robo Kent. And the story itself, really interesting. I'm going to talk about it a lot with Seven Samurai, but I really enjoy these movies where they kind of like get a group of ragtag people together. And then that's like the main premise for the movie. And that's what The Usual Suspects does. Now, what you don't realize at the beginning is how orchestrated getting this group together was in the first place. But there's just these little things where it's like, okay, why is Verbal Kint in this group of five? That makes no sense. Why is Verbal Kint the only one who survived the shootout on the boat? Like, there's just these little things that you're seeing. And it's like, okay, this is weird. Something feels off, and you should be thinking something feels off the entire time you're watching the movie, in my opinion.
So here's where I go with this. So I wanted you to preface, and then Andrew Denson, Coach Drew, coming in here big. Every time I show it to people, they normally get annoyed with the twist because it's obvious and always happens. And I just kind of stare at them in disgust. Also, shout out Stephen Baldwin. First of all, acting in this movie, phenomenal character actors across the board. Chaz Palminteri, Giancarlo Esposito in one of his earlier roles. Gabrielle Byrne is absolutely phenomenal. Stephen Baldwin, this might be the best performance of any Baldwin ever in anything, unless maybe, I don't know, the Flintstones, Viva Las Vegas, Viva Rock Vegas, sorry. Kevin Pollak, great in this movie. And Benicio Del Toro in one of his first roles, just absolutely phenomenal. Can't understand a word he says the entire movie. Here's why this movie is phenomenal, why it's in my top 100, why the next time I watch it, I'll probably move it up, and why it's always going to hover somewhere between like 30 and 80 for me. Like, I feel like it just bounces. Here's what I feel with this movie. Put yourself in the shoes of 1995.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So pretend that it's 1995 and you had no idea any of this was happening. You didn't know about the twist. You'd never heard of Bryan Singer. Kevin Spacey was a relative unknown. Gabrielle Byrne had been in a couple Coen Brothers movies, and that's it. There's no hype around this movie except it's a good mystery movie. That's all you know. That's it. Now you sit down and you watch this movie, and when you're following the breadcrumbs the entire time are leading you to Keaton is alive, and Keaton set up Verbal Kint for this entire thing. And that Keaton really is Kaiser Soze. That's where it's going the entire time. When you don't know there's a doozy of a twist, that revelation at the end of it's Kaiser Soze, it's Keaton, blah, 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 that's pretty devastating. You're like, oh my God, where did this come from? This is crazy. I did not see this coming. Oh no. But the problem is now the hype around this movie is it has the twist ending of all twist endings. Here's the thing. This movie is the definitive twist ending in film history. And I mean that from the bottom of my heart. Christopher McQuarrie, with his first film, wrote the definitive twist ending in film history in 1995. We'd seen twist endings before this. We saw it in the Cabinet of Dr. Caligari all the way back in the 20s. Like, this had been around. The twist endings weren't new. But this is the definitive twist ending because it was attached to a popular movie that picked up award recognition and was incredibly well made. Well, now what's the problem though? It's the same thing with a movie like Animal House or you go with a Hangover, which is newer, but still, or The Godfather or The Beatles or anything, The Color Red. When you're called the best over and over and over and over and over again, people research you and look for reasons to hate you. It doesn't matter. The Godfather has the most mistakes of any movie ever made, if you go on IMDb, because people love to pretend that they're smarter than the people who made The Godfather. And guess what? You're not. You're not smarter than them. And The Usual Suspects suffers from this weight, because when I saw this movie when I was 8 years old, and I didn't know that there was going to be a twist ending, and I'm 8 years old, I'm like, holy shit, where did that? My little 8-year-old brain is cursing like an MF-er. I'm pretty much talking like Fenster. And it's just like, hey, what the hell is going on here? And then you hear from people who saw it before they heard about it. And it's, oh my God, it's the best. It's the best. But then what happens is every time this movie is discussed, it is discussed as having one of the best endings of all time. Well, because it's been copied to death, it no longer resonates with people who have seen this before and don't understand the gravity of this twist. And they feel like, oh, I'm smart. This movie, to go to a Survivor reference, this movie is the losers who hang out on spoiled Survivor all day and then come in the chat when Alexa and I are talking about the episode and what we think is going to happen and say, oh, you're reading the spoilers. Because they have been spoiled and now they're spoiling it for everybody else by leaving that comment because what one of us is saying must be right. That's this movie, because everybody is that kid who's like, oh, well, you're just spoiled. I'm going to know it. And then they look it up. They find out what's going to happen and they watch it. How do you know how to judge something? How do you know how to judge the Red Wedding if you know what the Red Wedding is? And that's what this movie is. And I would love it if I could find somebody who knew nothing about it. And I just say, hey, you want to watch Usual Suspects? Sure. Didn't know anything about it. Got Kevin Spacey and Gabrielle Byrne. Oh, okay, cool. I don't know who the hell those people are. Kevin Spacey's a creep, right? Yeah. Sit down, watch it, and just have no idea what was going on. And then see the ending, because then it blows your mind. But it's when you go into something expecting a twist, what are you doing the whole time? Well, who is it? 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 But it's like Seven. If you don't even know Kevin Spacey's in that movie. I had a friend, air quotes, in college who was like, oh, it was so obvious it was Kevin Spacey. How was it obvious it was Kevin Spacey? Oh, well, I knew he was in the movie. Well, yeah, if you know he's in the movie, obviously it's obvious in Seven, but he's not even in the credits, so it's not obvious that it's Kevin Spacey. And that's how it is with this movie. If you can get yourself out of that without knowing that there's a twist, you watch it happen. Now, my second point, I know I've talked for a lot, but these are like my main things with this movie. My second point is, to me, this movie is the pure fun of storytelling. Mm-hmm. I was looking up Letterboxd reviews for this, and it was a lot of people who were clearly annoyed that they knew the twist and were like, F this movie. It's convoluted. It's this, it's that, whatever. But here's the thing. Nothing in this movie happened, and everything in this movie happened. That is so much fun, because by having this story be told from Verbal Kint's point of view, we don't know what's real. We don't know what's not. We don't know if people are dead. We don't know if people are alive. We don't know who was on that boat. We don't know what was set up, what wasn't. The only things we know for sure are what the detectives are saying to us. We know those things are real. We don't know if anything from Kevin Spacey's story is real. He might not be Kaiser Soze. Kaiser Soze could be Pete Postlewaite, the lawyer. It could be Kobayashi, who's just picking him up at the end and saying, good job, you did this for me. Like, there is no guarantee it's Kevin Spacey. There's no guarantee that any of this even happened. And there's no guarantee that this Kaiser Soze is real. Now, granted, the guy does, like, here's the picture of him and everything like that. But it's an alias, or maybe it's just who he thought was Kaiser Soze. We don't know. I think that's the brilliance of this. It's all storytelling, and it's a compelling, convoluted story. Why is it convoluted? Because it's the story that Verbal Kint is spinning to these guys while he's just trying to keep them talking until they let him leave.
Yeah, that's one of the most interesting things about this movie is that one of the things that I found kind of like maybe upset about this movie at the end, but also like really impressed me at the end, is the moment you realize Verbal Kint made everything up when he's talking to the officers, because it does the pan of the back wall. And at first you're like, that's a lot of coincidences that all of these things were mentioned in the story. And then you realize, oh, it's not a coincidence. He made it up because he saw those names. He knew what he was doing the entire time, and he was fabricating everything. When you set up your movie with an unreliable narrator and then reveal that at the end, it can really alienate audiences. Because now they're wondering, well, did any of this happen? And while that is the point of The Usual Suspects and why The Usual Suspects is a good movie, it's because it does that and it stretches that. And the entire purpose of the movie is to be like, oh yeah, by the way, these are all lies. On a first viewing for someone who already knows the twist, it can be feel like a betrayal of filmmaking. But I think this movie, I think when I revisit this movie again and I watch it a second time, I would appreciate it even more. And I think it's one of those movies, like you said, Phil, it'll continuously go up and down your impression of it, where it depends like what part of a cycle of watching it you get to. The first time you watch this movie after a twist, if you know the twist already, you're watching it and you're like, okay, well, I see everything. Like, this isn't as great as everyone makes it out to be. The next time you watch it, you're like, okay, well, now I don't care about the fact that I'm seeing everything because now I know everything's a lie. Now what I need to do is just like engross myself in the story of it all. And then, you know, that cycle probably continues a lot from that point.
So what's fun about this movie and why I do enjoy watching, because a lot of twist movies, they don't work. After you know it once, it's over. I mean, there's some movies that it lands every time. Me, a movie like The Illusionist, I love that movie. I think it lands every time. I think it's incredibly well done, and it's a twist ending. But it's not this type of twist ending. But I love movies where Christopher McQuarrie earned it in this. He really did. And I think what people don't realize when they sit down and watch this now, 27 years later, people weren't alienated by this movie when it came out. This was all word of mouth, and you didn't have the internet, and there was no history built up of it's the greatest ending of all time. And not for nothing, Kevin Spacey's performance is one of the greatest villain roles of all time. I mean, it really is. Verbal Kint is up there amongst the best villains in film history. The thing is, now you know to look for it. How do you get out of that mindset? What I love about this movie is the first time I watched it, it blew my mind. The second time I watched it, I tried to piece together what made sense and where he was lying and where he wasn't. The third time I watched it, I realized I'm an idiot. None of it needs to be pieced together. It's literally just a story. Mm-hmm. And then the fourth time I watched it, I think was the time I actually enjoyed it the most, because I just sat down and I said, oh, this is Verbal Kent blabbing and blabbing and blabbing. And it's a director showing his version of the blabs. And that's it. It's over. That's all it is. That is all it is. There's nothing more to it. It is just him showing the blabs. And some of it might have happened. They went out to Los Angeles for some reason. They came from New York. But what was real about the lineup? I don't know what was real about the lineup. We know there was a lineup. We know Keaton went, was picked up by Kuyan. We know all that. But did Kaiser Soze set it up? Yeah, probably. But everything that follows that lineup is total fabrication. There doesn't, none of it might have happened. And some of it might be real, but that's the fun of it. And I think what's so amazing about what Macquarie did with this movie is he sat down and he told a story that had a great twist ending. But more importantly, he just told a great story. And for how convoluted and how much it goes over the top and blah, 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 this is how a criminal who is trying to send you down the wrong path would talk to you. And you think he's stupid because he's a cripple. I'm smarter than you. Okay. But he's smarter than you and you didn't realize it. Of course, he's going to talk about Skokie, Illinois, and I mean, whale, orca fat. I mean, you know, and all that, Redfoot and everything. It's all bullshit. The only thing we know for sure is that this Kobayashi guy is a real guy. We just don't know who he is. And not for nothing. And I don't think we get it confirmed. Or we might. He might have gotten pulled out at the end. But do we get it confirmed that Keaton's dead? We do, right? Because he was pulled out. Or do we not? Because it's Edie Finneran who's dead. I always forget.
I don't remember. The thing is, so the reason, one of the biggest complaints I have about this movie is the first thing we see in this movie is Keaton, as he's like lying there about to get shot, saying something Kaiser. Like, he acknowledges Kaiser Soze in that point. And because it's Keaton's character saying that there, it just doesn't make sense then that Keaton is Kaiser Soze. Because that feels like a very real situation that's happening in the movie. It doesn't feel like these fabricated lies that happen later in the movie. I think based on that, Keaton is dead. Obviously, it happens off screen, so we can't confirm. But I'm fairly certain Keaton is dead at the end of this film.
Well, but that's where it's leading you, though, is like they never find his body. They never find him washed up. They're finding other bodies. They're finding other dead people, but not Keaton. And they do. They show they hear the gunshots and then you see the explosion, but that's it. And you're led to believe that's how Kuyan's putting it together. You didn't know. You didn't see it. You didn't know. How could you possibly have known that this is what happened if you didn't experience it? And I think that is, I just think that's like I think that's a really cool element. You're really, and I know it's hard to believe this, but you really are not on the trail of Verbal Kent at all while this movie is going on. You're not. Like if you don't know that this happens, and like I know this because of the acclaim that this movie built up over time, talking to people who were in their 20s or 30s at the time. Yeah. When I was in film school, this is the movie I was talking about. Ordinary People was a movie a lot of people talked about. Screenwriting professors and stuff talked about this movie all the time, about what a shock it was when this movie came out and how unbelievable it was. That's why they were able to get such good named actors and stuff attached to it, because it was like oh my God, what is this? Like, what is this movie? We've never seen anything like this. And so with it, Keaton kind of being that, but then you're also sitting there and you're saying, okay, well, what are these cops trying to solve? They're trying to find this like mass murderer who set everybody up. How are they going to find this mass murderer? What are they going to do to find this mass murderer? And I just love the setup. Like, I just think it's a fun setup. And at the end of the day, we don't really know much more at the end than we did at the beginning.
It's also really important to note that the cops aren't looking for Kaiser Soze at the beginning of this film.
No.
They have no idea that that's who they're looking for, just like the audience doesn't. Kaiser Soze doesn't get mentioned until about the 45-minute mark of this film.
So the guy who's burning, the burn victim says, so at the beginning of the movie, Gabrielle Byrne does say, hey, Kaiser or whatever.
Yeah.
And then the burn victim starts saying Kaiser Soze, and Giancarlo Esposito has a strong reaction to it, but it doesn't get mentioned in the actual interview room with Kevin Spacey until about 45 minutes in, when Chaz Palminteri comes in and goes, who the hell is Kaiser Soze, or whatever that is, or something like that.
So that's the interesting thing, is that the cops don't even know that they're looking for some mastermind here. The only reason Verbalkind is in there is because he survived whatever happened, and they want to know what happened. Mm-hmm. Like, the situation itself lends itself to exactly what Verbalkind does here, which is where the genius of the screenwriting comes from, right? It's a natural reaction to what's happening here. Is Verbalkind, whether he is Kaiser Soze or not, knows he can just make everything up because he knows he's the only person who survived.
He knows the only person. And the other thing is, too, he knows that Keaton was the bigger fish for them. Keaton was the one, because Keaton was the cop who was dirty. And of course, that's going to make all the cops go at him. He's the MF-er who he killed cops. He was a crooked cop, whatever, gave cops a bad name. He's supposed to be dead. All of a sudden, he's alive. He's not allowed to go clean as far as Kuyan is concerned. Kuyan needs to see this guy cook, and he won't believe he's dead until he's dead. But this leads to the illusion of it, with he walked into a warehouse, it exploded, and then he resurfaced a year later or 2 years later, whatever it is. Now he's on this boat. They can't find his body. Where's he at? Like, those are the things that I just think, like, really lead you down that path. And then what you're waiting for, even in that moment back in the day when they knew there was going to be a twist coming, but they didn't know what it was going to be, you're wondering, okay, what did Keaton do to make all this happen? Like, what is this identity type twist? I don't know if you ever saw the movie Identity, but that was like, that had an ending where it was like, oh,
yeah,
okay. It kind of lackluster, but it's like, oh, that makes sense. That's what you're expecting in this movie. You're expecting something to come completely out of left field. And in reality, it doesn't come out of left field at all. It's been right in front of you the entire time, but we had never seen a movie like this. We know Verbalkind is a cripple. We know it. We are told it so many times. How could a cripple be doing all this? How could he kill all these people on a boat? We have been told it so many times. That last shot of him walking down with the sidewalk and the foot and the arm and the hand, it's like, how did we do that? We had never seen anything like that now. 3 years later, it's spoofed in Scary Movie. Of course you're going to say we've seen it a million times if you're sitting down to watch this movie now. It has been done a million times, but this was the first of the million.
Yeah, and the big thing is that it really goes to show the subtlety that McQuarrie put into the script here, because it's just the mentioning of Kent being a cripple the entire time and using the word cripple over and over again in the script. It's subliminal messaging for the audience, so that you just believe Verbalkind is a cripple, because that is what is being told to you over and over and over again.
Well, and it's the brilliance of calling him Verbalkind. He doesn't talk. That's the thing. I was just about to tell you to shut the fuck up. He doesn't talk the entire, that's his role. And that's why they call him Verbal as a joke, because he's the cripple who takes people for money and everything like that without him even having to say words. And now it's him telling the story. So we're seeing him in an uncomfortable position for himself. And yet in reality, he's the one who's telling the story the best out of everybody. But calling him Verbalkind and the cripple and all that, we are told so many times, all he's good at is talking. He's not talking, but that's his thing. He's not physical. So he's got to be the verbal guy, you know, and he barely talks. He barely says anything. We get that. And it's these little hints that are telling you the whole time that there's something else there, but you're seeing him in a chair the whole movie. He can't even light his own cigarette. How could this be that guy? That's really what it comes down to more than anything. Not so much that he was the murderer, but the fact that he's just an able-bodied person who's running around and can do everything. And he's just that invested in the role and that messed up of a person. That's what shocks people. And that's what leaves the lingering effect on everybody when it's over.
Yeah, absolutely. And like I said, that reveal is done really well. And it's still impossible, even if you know the twist, to deny how good this movie is because of Kevin Spacey's performance. I think the best part of Kevin Spacey's performance, though, is right as he tells the Kaiser Soze story in the police station.
Mm-hmm, I agree.
Because throughout the entire movie, Verbalkind is such a controlled character. He's so controlled and timid, well-measured, a lot of subtlety to the character. As he's telling this story about Kaiser Soze, there is so much pride in his voice. He is a different person when he is telling that story. And if you're not paying attention enough and you don't pick up on it, like, absolutely, there's no way you could tell Verbalkind was Kaiser Soze. That was the moment where I was like, you can easily tell these guys are Soze here.
And see, what for me, what that was more than anything is the awe that criminals have for other criminals who are better mm-hmm. than them. And so for me, when that moment's happening, he's like, and he showed them what true power really was. And he shoots them all in the head, and then he does what, like, that's the story he chooses to believe. It's the same way, like, you're told a story. Like, if I was to tell you a story of, like, the Usual Suspects, and I was to be like, yeah, it's this movie, it's these guys, they get called in, they're criminals, they get called into a lineup, and then, you know, but only one, then everything goes wrong, and only one person survives, and you got to see what happens next. Like, if I was telling that story and actually passionate about it and, like, trying to sell somebody in this movie, I'd be so into it. I'd be, like, in awe of Christopher McQuarrie, which I was with this movie. That's how Kaiser Soze is with this. Like, he was that much of a master that, oh my God. And then he goes and he kills these people. It's insane. Like, this is what he's doing. Boom. It's just, like, unheard of. But it's not unheard of. It's him just fabricating whatever he wants to fabricate. But I see what you're saying, where it's like he has pride in it. But to me, it's more of awe for this person. It's the way that serial killers will be like, oh, well, this was my inspiration. This serial killer was my inspiration. You know what I'm saying?
No, I definitely understand what you're saying. I don't know. It's just the point. That was the point where I texted you. And it was like, it's so obvious that these guys are so sick.
Yeah. Which it always is if you know the twist.
Yeah. But in the end, like, I ended up giving this movie 3.5 stars, and I docked it half a star because of the action sequence, in all honesty.
The boat sequence.
It was just like, this movie was doing really well. It's so good. I prefer the dialogue heavy films. This action sequence was just too long and too, I mean, it's really Bryan Singer-y in the end. Like, just too, like, over the top of it, that it just felt like it took away from everything else this film was doing.
Well, what I like about this action sequence is it's when it's revealed that everything in this movie was a MacGuffin. This is really the point of the movie where you should realize that Kevin Spacey is Kaiser Soze. Yeah. Because, one, how does he know what everybody's doing? And if this is the story he's telling, oh, well, what's going on here? And he's just saying, like, he was a witness to everything. He's witnessing this and that, whatever. He goes by and sees Kevin Pollak laying on the ground dead. Not that he's not claiming he killed him, but he sees him laying on the ground dead, like, all of this stuff. So what I love, though, is where's the coke? There's no coke. There's no coke. And Gabriel Byrne screaming that at Stephen Baldwin. It's like, we got to get off this boat. Like, clearly this is a setup. And that's when you realize that all of this was a setup. From the moment that the setup actually happened with the lineup, all the way through here, you think they're going on there and there's going to be, like, some big confrontation with somebody. And in fact, you get the exact opposite of that. And then Kevin Spacey just blows it up. And you know from the beginning that you're like, okay, here's where we're going to find out who Kaiser Soze is. And you still don't get that revelation while they're on the boat. All you're really getting is whoever this guy is, he was sending them out there to die and cover up the fact that he needed to murder these guys and wasn't going to get away with it in another way. That's all he's doing in this moment. And I think that's why I respect this scene. I do agree with you, though. I don't need it. But the other scenes, I personally love the New York's finest taxi service. I think is such a great scene. That part's great. I love the part with where they go into the parking garage and we see Verbalkind shoot and kill them. The one guy shoots him right in the head. Like, I like those moments. Yes. And the boat sequence does have so much built up to it. But then you're like, well, wait, what's the payoff here? There's nothing there. The twist can't be that there's no coke. There's got to be something else going on. And then that's when Chaz Palminteri is like, it's Keaton. And then it leads to the greatest reveal sequence of all time with Kobayashi and Skokie, Illinois, and Redfoot, and everything just scattered around. And that's it. and goes running out, and like that, he's gone. My guess is you'll never see him again.
Yeah, this movie, I feel like people in retrospect look at this movie and they're asking who's Kaiser Soze, when that's not really what this movie is positing as a question the entire movie. Because again, like you said, it's leading you to believe that Keaton is Kaiser Soze the entire time. And if that's the case, your question as an audience viewing this isn't who's Kaiser Soze, it's how did he pull this off?
Yeah.
Which is a question that's just never answered. And that takes guts to write a script like that, where the main question you are asking the entire movie never gets answered, and you subvert it by answering a different question at the end of the film.
Because now you know that he is Kaiser Soze, but yeah, like you said, we are no closer to understanding how he did this. However, we do understand that he was good enough to pull it off. That's what we know. We know he was good enough because he was able to tell this story and lie to this guy, but we will never get the answer to what actually happens to Keaton and what went on with all five of these guys when they were, you know, doing everything in between.
Exactly.
So anyway, so that's that movie. John, what was the best thing you watched this week?
I watched a lot of very good things this week. I went on a bit of a Howard Hawks binge this week, watched His Girl Friday, The Big Sleep, and Rio Bravo this weekend, all phenomenal films. But the one I have to put up above, which is, it's going to be contentious, I know, it's been a divisive film so far, is Alex Garland's new film, Men. I think this film was absolutely astounding. Alex Garland's just able to create this tense atmosphere that never is unrelenting the entire film. I found myself looking at every single inch of the screen, just trying to see if I was missing anything anytime anything was going on. It was disturbing. It was tense. It just, to me, showed that Alice Garland deserves to be in the conversation with those other new masters of horror we see emerging now.
Yeah, I have to check it out. I haven't seen it yet, but you're right. It is definitely polarizing. I know that this has definitely been his most hit or miss with the reviews. So I'm curious to see what that one is all about. For me, it was Paths of Glory. I finally revisited this one for the first time since high school. And this movie is just, it's a different level. I ended up bumping this up. I have my Kubrick ranking over on Letterboxd. I ended up bumping this up to my third favorite Kubrick movie of all time. And remember, we were supposed to talk about The Shining 5 weeks ago. So that tells you where this is going to end up. When I'm eventually able to redo this, I remember watching this the first time and being like, okay, like, you know, it's a little melodramatic, whatever, over the top. Watching it this time, I was like, I was an idiot. But first of all, this is quite possibly the greatest anti-war movie ever made. And that's coming from somebody who has The Deer Hunter as their number one movie of all time, which is the most anti-war movie ever made. But this movie, just in a way that only Kubrick can do, and it's not funny, it's not like Strangelove where it's a comedy, it's a very serious dark drama, but it just shows the absurdity of everything so freaking well. And the absurdity of ranking in the military and how you can get away with anything if you're a little bit higher up. One of the most frustrating movies you'll ever watch, but it is so powerful. And it's essentially, I gotta say, it is one of the best paced movies of all time. 88 minutes long, which, hey, I'm a huge Strangelove fan. I think that movie's 85 minutes long. Yeah. Kubrick could do anything. He could do that, or he could do Eyes Wide Shut and Barry Lyndon and Space Odyssey and make these 2 hour 40 to 3 hour and 10 minute movies. But this movie just flies by. It doesn't get melodramatic. Everything is purposeful. Every conversation is purposeful. Brilliant movie. Came out in 1957. Literally 1957 is becoming one of, if not my favorite year for movies of all time. Mm-hmm. I've talked about it a lot now. Still haven't watched. We did watch Throne of Blood, right? Yeah, we did watch Throne of Blood. But Throne of Blood, 12 Angry Men, The Seventh Seal, Wild Strawberries, Paths of Glory, The Bridge on the River Kwai, Sweet Samoa's Success, The Cranes Are Flying, Witness for the Prosecution, and I haven't even seen Knights of Cabiria. It's absurd. Like, it is absurd, especially since this was the 50s when they weren't making 100 movies a week. Like, that just wasn't happening. It's all world cinema. But this really is one of Kubrick's finest, and a must watch for anybody who's a fan of these kinds of movies. Just check it out.
Yeah, I definitely have to go and watch it. But it was removed off Netflix last week, and I went to watch it this week, and it wasn't there.
I watched it on Amazon Prime. That's how I got it. So, yep. Anywho. All right, John. So let's talk about Seven Samurai. So you have Seven Samurai in here replacing the Fellowship of the Ring, which is essentially Nine Samurai. Yes. Why Seven Samurai? Where's this thing going to end up for you? And yeah, why'd you pick this to go alongside Fellowship?
So, I mean, like you already hinted at why I picked this, because the Fellowship of the Ring is just such a story of like this group of nine people coming together, forming this just cause to destroy the One Ring and everything like that. And Seven Samurai really parallels that story a lot when you think about it. Yes, there's no mythological aspect to the film, but we still see these seven very different characters coming together to do this incredibly honorable thing of defending this village. And I'm just really glad I hadn't seen this movie before making my top 100 so that we could talk about it in place of Fellowship of the Ring, because I do think the parallels are incredibly similar. We see very similar character archetypes throughout some of these characters. But Seven Samurai, I think, does it even better than Fellowship of the Ring. This is a movie that's going to end up in my top 10 when I remake my top 100. I think this is one of the best movies ever made.
Yeah, I mean, I will agree with you that I think this is one of the best movies ever made. It's not going to be my top 100. And when I originally watched it, I gave it 4.5. Like, hey, it could be my top 100. And then that night I watched Paths of Glory and I was like, well, this is definitely going to be my top 100. And then I went back and actually looked at some of the movies I've given 4.5. And I was like, there's just no space for Seven Samurai. Mm-hmm. Mainly because Fellowship. So this is where it's kind of like with the Usual Suspects. Fellowship has the nostalgia for me.
Of course.
Seven Samurai doesn't, and Seven Samurai never will. Seven Samurai, I watched, somehow it took me 30 years to watch this movie.
Yeah.
This piece of perfection took me 30 years. But like I said to you through text, this movie is like Schindler's List for me. Brilliant, no questions asked, phenomenally well made, great story, heartbreaking, exciting. You know, Schindler's List has some exciting moments. I mean, it's dramatic. But ultimately, while I can acknowledge that it's one of the greatest movies ever made, I don't know if I'm going to watch Seven Samurai again anytime soon. At some point, I will. This is definitely not a one-off movie for me. Like, this is a badass movie that I want to watch again. But that's where it takes a knock for me. 3 hours and 27 minutes. It's a lot of time to sit down and watch this movie. Like, let's be real. It earns those minutes, though. I mean, I have Return of the King on here, and that's 3 hours and 20 minutes. And what's another 26 minutes on top of The Deer Hunter? So, like, whatever. But with subtitles, that does make it a little bit different of a thing. And there's a lot of dialogue in this movie. Mm-hmm. What I will say, though, is Seven Samurai, the first hour and a half of this movie, some of my favorite moments of the adventure genre ever. I actually like that more than the more exciting stuff that takes place in the back half of this. I thought the setup was great. That's why I also have Fellowship of the Ring, though, in my top 10, because I love the Shire stuff. And I love the build up to the actual Fellowship of the Ring, which a lot of epics fail to do. Seven Samurai does it brilliantly. Mm-hmm. Second to only Fellowship of the Ring, in my opinion.
Yeah, it's one of those stories where it's just so interesting. A lot of it comes from Kurosawa's everything that he decides to do in this film. There's so many great decisions Kurosawa makes with this film. The decision to start this film off immediately with her inciting incident. Mm-hmm. Where one of the farmers overhears the bandits saying when they're coming back, and then giving us Rikichi's immediate, like, no, we are standing up to these bandits this time. And then letting us take so much time to learn about each of these samurai, to figure out what each of these characters are, and then for him to just introduce some of the greatest characters ever put in film.
Yeah, what's funny too is the beginning of this movie happens so quickly, and yet everything in this movie takes its time. That is that inciting incident happens so fast. And then the rest of the movie, it really does. Like, you get to know every single person who's chosen. You get to know, with the exception maybe of the one guy who survives at the end, the bald guy, you don't really get to know him all that well compared to some of the others.
Yeah, Ichirogi, she is just kind of like, he's that one character that comes in, and him and Kanbei have that conversation of, this might be the one that kills us. Mm-hmm. And like, that's kind of all you know. All you know is that him and Kanbei know each other going into this.
Yeah, that's really it. And you don't really get much more on than that. But you take your time getting to know them. You take your time getting to know the villagers. You get take your time getting to see their plan in action. You know, as they're being attacked by the bandits, all that stuff. Like, you get to see all of it take place, and it takes place in a very meaningful way where it's like, these are seven washed up samurai. Like, there's one good samurai in the bunch, and that's the guy who gets shot at the end. I forget what his name is. I couldn't remember their names, but
I wrote them all down just so we had them.
Oh, thank you. But that guy, like, he's the best one. He's my favorite one. The guy who's just like, you know, he just cuts people in half because that's what he does. If this movie was made nowadays, that's what would be happening. But I love that character. I think that's a great character. And he's the only one who's actually like a good samurai. Everybody else is old, or they're drunk, or they're fat, or they're ronin. They don't have masters. Yeah. They have nothing to do. And so they take this on. And I love the idea that, like, the seven of them couldn't win this. They needed everybody else in the village who doesn't know what the hell they're doing. And even still, with everybody else in the village, you know, ultimately they're going to win, but you don't know how many people are going to have to be lost in order for them to win. And I love, love, love the melancholy ending of, we still didn't even win this one. Like, we didn't win. They won. The villagers won. They have their homes. We didn't win anything. We lost four. We lost more than half of us. And now we're leaving. We didn't win. I think that's awesome, and I think it really, like, speaks to the depth of this movie and what Kurosawa was going for with this.
Yeah, there's so many just little details in this film, and, like, the themes of this film of, like, I really like the contrast between the end of the first half of the film, right before the intermission, and the end of the film, where we do have that melancholy ending, and we have one of the most iconic shots in all of cinema, when it just, like, pans up and you see the graves of the four samurai and the lost villagers at the end, and it just cuts to black there. Contrasting with, honestly, one of the best motivational speeches in any film ever, at the right before the intermission, where Kanbei's speaking, and he just says, he's talking about the three houses on the other side of the river that they have to sacrifice, essentially, and he's talking about how we can't sacrifice the village to defend these three, but we need you to come fight for the village, because, like, by protecting others, you save yourself. And, like, that's just entirely, like, this massive theme with all seven of these samurai too, right? We see while Rikichi and Yaoi and Bonzo are all out trying to get samurai, that a lot of these samurai are looking for glory. They're looking for wealth and glory, but these are the ones who were willing to save themselves by protecting others.
Yeah, these, like, and we get that in the conversation from Shimada. I think that's him, right? Like, that's, like, the main guy, Shimada, the older guy.
Yeah, yeah.
When he's talking all of them about, like, you're not going to get much from this. They'll feed you, and that's really it. That's all you're going to get. And, like, that is all we get. But at the same time, like, I think the statements about, like, community in Japan, especially during this time period, and, like, all of that, and, like, that the samurai were meant to be this honorable thing. We hear all about, pretend that, you know, we got to make our women look like men, and we got to do this because we don't trust the samurai, but they ultimately were meant to be honorable. And the history of samurai now is that they were honorable, and that, like, that is, like, the, you know, the honorable thing to do. They'd fall on their sword and all of that. Like, I like that we get there, sort of. There's still some of them who aren't in it for all that stuff, you know, like, they're kind of going, but I like that we get the story on each of them, why each one of them would want to be a part of this. Why would they want to be there for this when they don't have to be? Like, this movie could have been really quick and easy, where they could have just said, hey, we need Seven Samurai. And they're like, no, screw you. We're not going to do this. Mm-hmm. Too bad if you guys get murdered. It's not our problem. And then, you know, you play the Curb music and the movie ends. Like, but it's Kurosawa's like vision of what it meant to be honorable in the 1500s Japan and what it means now in the 1900s, 400 years after, what that meant to be honorable in Japan. And, you know, we can't, like you said, we can't save the people on the other side and put the village at risk. So if you stay there, like, you're probably going to die. But if we can come together for like that greater good, we're going to win. And I think that's really been the message through all time, right? If people could just come together for the greater good, everything would be great. But what happens is people always come together for the greater good, and then they let power get to them once they accomplish something, and then they separate again. This movie is pretty much saying, like, what happens if we really can stick together? We defeat the bandits. But then at the end of the day, what's the role for the samurai? Nothing. They have no role. It was a thankless job, but they did it anyway.
But that's what I love about the depiction of samurai in this movie, is that they are such flawed characters, each and every one of them. Even just in the idea and the sense of samurai in general, we have that that monologue by Kikuchiyo where he's talking about how the samurai make it so the farmers are killing samurai.
Yeah.
And how this is all because the samurai, you know, during war would raid villages and rape women and things like that. This is the direct result of samurai. And that's why we get into this world where we're at a place in time in Japan where, like, the samurai are kind of being hunted, right? They were talking about it, where they're being hunted. They're being hunted after they fight and are weakened, and people are taking all their stuff because they feel it's the only way they can keep going. Mm-hmm. And it's because we have that flawed class, but we still have, because we have Kabe Shimada as this incredible leader in this group, like, we still have hope for these samurai, despite the fears of the villagers, despite the fact that everyone's like, oh no, they're not going to be able to do this, and they're just going to, you know, have their way with our women.
Why do you think that a movie like Seven Samurai, a movie like The Fellowship of the Ring, like these movies, we have seen this try to be replicated so many times. I mean, this is an adventure story old as time, right? I mean, it was, how many people can we get? They got to take on somebody and they're going to fail. Why do you think a movie like Seven Samurai resonates so much with people, despite the fact that it's about something that Western culture has almost no understanding of, which is samurai history and things like that, really just these villages in general with the farms and everything like that. Why do you think a movie like this resonates so much when it's not a fantasy? Like, The Fellowship of the Ring is a fantasy. So it's like, oh, I love being in that world. I love being in the Shire and Middle Earth and whatever. This is Japan. This is a real place. This is what was happening. Why does this work?
A lot of it, I think, comes down to character work. The fact that these characters are so defined, that it's not just like the Seven Samurai who are defined, but also a lot of the farmers are defined throughout this film. Mm-hmm. And I think if we're looking for like analogs into the Western world, like, this is essentially an Arthurian legend. Mm-hmm. If you're like really getting into it. And I think that's why it's so successful, is that this story, while it doesn't have direct Western parallels, is still a very ubiquitous story throughout the world.
Well, and we've seen it remade 7,000 times. I mean, as a child, The Magnificent Seven was one of my favorite movies ever. The 1960 John Sturges movie. Like, yeah. I loved that movie as a kid. It's the same thing as this, except...
Well, it's literally the same thing.
Well, it's not literally the same thing, because I was actually reading something interesting from Kurosawa about how he did not like that movie, and he said this is not an adaptation of The Seven Samurai. It's not. Like, he was very adamant about that because the culture is so different. And The Magnificent Seven definitely takes its time, definitely draws it out, definitely builds the world, all of that stuff. I mean, it's a 2-hour and 8-minute movie, but it still ultimately knows, like, we're going to shoot them up and that's going to be it. This movie gets so much more into like the history and the I can't think of the word. What is the word? The legend of the samurai And yeah. like all of that, like what were they doing? What were they trying to accomplish? It gets so much more into that. Whereas like this, the Magnificent Seven is very much just about like, we're in the West, man. We're going to come and we're going to kill these bastards, yeah. like whatever. Like this movie, like I texted you, one of the things that actually kind of frustrated me in the second half and keeps this from being, you know, one of my top 100 is how much he broke up the action at the end. But then again, I say to myself, well, that's how it was. Like, that is mm-hmm. how it should be. But I was thinking about the Magnificent Seven. I think there's two battles. They fight, and then they retreat, and then they come back, and they fight, and they kill them. Like, that's it. That's the end yeah. of the movie. This was fight, next day, fight, next day, fight, next day. But it's more of that strategy and the planning and the attention to detail of the Japanese culture that mm-hmm. the Wild West didn't have. The Wild West was coming, guns a-blazing, and hope that you don't die. Like, that was it.
Yeah.
This is so much more thoughtful. And I think mm-hmm. that's why it probably stands the test of time and passes through, you know, culture after culture after culture, and why so many people want to try to remake this movie. It's just a shame that they really don't know how to make this movie, because so many people have tried to remake it and they just fall on their face because I think they miss what makes it so interesting, which is mm-hmm. the thoughtfulness on top of the fact that we're watching seven people like take on it's thoughtful underdog story. That's mm-hmm. what we want. And it's epic. And it has everything you could want with the expanses and all that stuff. A lot of people try to remake this and they just skip over that part. And they're like, ooh, it's seven versus, you know, 100. I mean, look at the Magnificent Seven remake from 2016 is one of the worst movies mm-hmm. ever made. I mean, it's an absolute disaster and it's a joke and it's terrible. And it's like, what? They missed the point.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's one of the things is like some people look at this movie as just like a numbers disparity and like the underdog of these seven samurai, but that's not it. It's so much built on the character, right? One of the most character defining moments I think we've ever seen in a film is when we're first introduced to Kenbei Shimada and he's shaving his head to be a mm-hmm. monk to capture or to kill a thief and rescue this child. Like, that is such an honorable thing to do, especially when you consider, like, that top knot is a status symbol in Japan. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So having him cut the status symbol of him being a samurai so that he can do the honorable thing there is what sets him apart from a lot of these other characters we see in these ensemble films where they get these ragtag groups together. This is someone who is the epitome of what these farmers are looking for. And mm-hmm. his gravitas is enough to bring in these other six people to assist them.
Yeah, no, I think I think that's my favorite character. And it's funny to see Yul Brynner try to play that in The Magnificent Seven because mm-hmm. it's so different.
Yeah.
This guy is so convincing. And I love like the, if he comes through, try to whack him as hard as you can, and then he'll get stopped. And like, you know, he's setting up his disciple, air quotes, to fail every time. But he knows the samurai way so well. He knows that culture so well. He knows what's going to work and not work to determine who's worthwhile and who's not worthwhile. And I think that character, I always thought Toshiro Mifune was the main mm-hmm. character in this movie.
Yeah.
Like when I didn't know anything about it, he's on all the posters. He's obviously the famous one, like all that. But seeing that it wasn't him and that it was this grounded, wiser, like you said, like willing to do anything to save this child, that elevates this so much because he's ready to go in there with five. He's ready to go in there with four. Whatever he can get, he's going to go in there and he's going to figure it out. He just wants seven. And he thinks with seven, he could win. And ultimately, what he ends up proving is with four, he probably could have done it because it's four who die. And that's what he had said. Like, we need the east, the west, the south, and the north. Like, whatever.
Yeah.
And then you get all the villagers. But I just, like, I love that that's the main character. Because that makes this movie more compelling, that you have a likable, thoughtful character. Not just like what we envision as like the samurai of like, we're going to go in, we're going to be cool and swift and just get it done. No, like he knows that if it's not well planned, it's over and they're going to lose.
And that's another beautiful thing that Kurosawa does in this film. He spends the time on the tactics of this defense. He mentions that defending is harder than on offense. And he spends the time going through every single plan. There is not a single moment in this film where you don't understand why these characters are doing what they're doing.
Well, and a lot of people skip these parts in movies. Mm-hmm. And again, I think these are some of the most fascinating parts of the movie. I really was like, I'm telling you, like the battle scenes are when I was like, okay, like this is okay. Just get to the end. What's going to happen? I love the planning and the strategizing and everything. And like, it did remind me, and it came out 3 years before, but it reminds me of David Lean's Bridge on the River Kwai, which that movie is so much about everything else than what the actual story is. And there's so much planning. And that is what is so cool about this movie, though, is it's explaining to you, like, why is this not defensible? Where do we have to let them in? Well, we have to let them somewhat in, because if we don't let them in, then we can't trap them, then we can't defeat them, then we can't separate them. We need to let them in one area, but we are going to be ready for it. They're not going to be able to surprise us. We're going to flood this and do that and whatever. Like, I love that we know all of that. That it's not just a, oh, well, you know, it happened because it happened, and these people were just idiots who kept riding down the same path. They didn't have a choice. So that's why they kept riding down that path. I love that. I love that attention to detail, and I don't care that we spend nearly 40 minutes on all of that. I think that's great, and I think that's good for filmmaking, and I think that is part of the reason why this one stands the test of time, because if you cut all of that out and you just get into the action sequences, well, then it's just any other movie that is us versus them. It really is. Like, exactly. Like, that's it. But it still has the planning, which has a payoff, rather than just like plan, and now let's, you know, show the flag on the battlefield, and then it's over.
Yeah, exactly. And the fact that we still see, I really enjoy that the first thing we see them do in regards to the bandit is that night raid, and we lose someone because of it. Mm-hmm. That, like, they make a decision, and
it one of the most likable ones, too.
Yeah. Like, yeah, losing, who died at that point?
That was the, fun guy.
Yeah, Hachi, right? And, like, we get that line from Shimada afterwards of, you said he'd be a light in the tense times, and those haven't even started yet.
Yep.
But having that night raid, having Hachi die there, and, like, seeing that we get so much exposition in that scene, because we find out that Rikishi's wife's been taken by these bandits.
Yep.
And, like, everything just gets answered here, and we see, because someone dies immediately in the first confrontation with these people, when it looks like they're going to get away, all of a sudden you as an audience are just like, oh, this might not go well. They might lose.
Yeah, well, and now we're down to six, and we haven't even gotten to the battle yet. I mean, how many people did they actually kill out of the bandits in this scene to lose one of their own?
Yeah.
Not enough.
Exactly. No.
Not enough at all. Yeah, I mean, I think that's great. And to lose one of the more likable ones, I think, is a smart decision, too, because at this point, you have built up who the main characters are and everything like that. And that guy felt like he was one of the main characters for sure. Yeah. And have him be the first one to go. And you see that in The Magnificent Seven. A lot of them just kind of start going once the battle happens. Like, I'm pretty sure all of them go when the battle happens. I think Robert Vaughn or Brad Dexter might die earlier than that. I forget exactly how the order goes. I haven't seen it forever. But it's like, this movie, it doesn't give you, which this is a bullshit term that people invented for Game of Thrones, and it's stupid, but plot armor. That's a stupid statement, because every character that's ever been written has plot armor, because guess what? The writer is the one who's going to decide when people live or die and whether or not the plot will keep them alive or kill them. That is literally the definition of writing. So that's just an idiotic statement by losers. I love using the word losers here. But there is no plot armor in this. It's any of them could go. In your heart of hearts, you know that Shimada is going to be the one who is going to last the longest. Like, you do know that. But I was shocked when Tashira from Mifune died. I couldn't believe it. I thought the heroic death was the guy who got shot with the musket, and that was going to be it. Mm-hmm. And then Tashira Mifune dies.
Yeah. Toshiro Mifune's Kikuchiyo die at the very end here, I think it's just the perfect cap to one of the most incredible character story arcs in any film ever.
Ever. And not for nothing. I've seen a lot of the Kurosawa Mifune movies.
Yeah.
This is his best performance 100%. By far. And it's iconic and it's unbelievable. And it's all over the place. And like you said, one of the great character arcs in cinema history. Like it is just unbelievable what they do with this character, because not for nothing, there's not really much of an arc there. He is who he is the whole time. He's just not what they are used to.
And it's just the slow reveals of why his character is this way. Like when we're first introduced to him, he's watching Shimada deal with the thief. And then he gets turned away by Shimada at the beginning. And then he comes back as this drunk and everyone's making fun of him because they realize he's not actually who he says he is. And he's not actually a samurai. He just was like pretending to be one. Mm-hmm. And like, it's that running joke the entire time. And then we get to the village and he's integrating with these farmers so well. He knows about these farmers, and we find out he is a farmer. And then he comes out of the mill, or then he has the baby, and he's like, "This child is me." Mm-hmm. And you're just like, "I understand everything." And then to see him heroically die, killing the last bandit, at the end of this film, and have this honorable samurai death, and he's like, definitely a samurai at this point, because we've seen him do the reckless thing before when he gets the second musket.
Mm-hmm.
We see him like doing the thing for glory and he gets chastised for it, but now he's avenging Kyuzo's death and finishing these bandits off, and dies in the process. And it's just such an incredible conclusion to this character.
I agree. I absolutely loved it. I love these moments from this character. I love this character. I think it's great from start to finish. And I love that he is the last one to die, because we get the heroic death from, I forget what his name is, the stoic man.
Kyuzo.
I wanted to call him Aaron from Final Fantasy X. That's who he really is. But it's just, we get that and you're like, okay, it's over. Now Kikuchiyo is going to go and kill, and then that's going to be it. And he's going to be the hero. And for him to die the hero, it really is. It really is a great decision. But I think this also goes back to, it's 1954. You're a Japanese director. You had freedom that you just don't have these days. And so you could get away with that decision of, I need to kill off this character. Like, it needs to happen. I forget the death order and who dies in The Magnificent Seven, because like I said, I haven't seen it forever. I don't think Steve McQueen dies. I don't think Yul Brynner dies, because they can't die. It's Steve McQueen and Yul Brynner. They can't. Robert Vaughn, he can go. Charles Bronson, he can go. Those two guys can't go, though. And I think that was the interesting thing with this movie, is like, Mifune, he can go. You had the freedom to do it. And I mean, I just talked about how 1957 might be my favorite year for movies ever. That was 3 years later. A lot of freedom there. And a lot of times when these directors get to have a little bit of freedom, there's going to be a lot of crap, like anything that Zack Snyder touches. But there's a lot of really good movies that come out of it, too. And Seven Samurai is 100% one of them. And definitely a movie that lives up to the hype that it has been placed on it throughout 60 years, pretty much now. 70 years, right?
70 years, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a movie that if you haven't had a chance to sit down and watch it because you just didn't have the 3.5 hours, or you're a little tentative about watching a movie from 1954 that's in Japanese, this is pivotal watching, in my opinion. This is a movie that everyone should see. If you like cinema, you have to watch this movie.
I'm disappointed in myself that I have not seen this movie, and I just turned 30. Like, I really am. Like, I was too
when I first watched it last year. I was like, how have I not watched this movie before?
Yeah. No, it's crazy. And it is a must watch for everybody. And yeah, if you're a cinephile and you haven't seen this, watch it. It's worth it. You get to see, this is a groundbreaking movie. It is groundbreaking and it is entertaining and it is compelling. And man, when you make a good adventure movie, I say this all the time, adventure movies are my favorite genre. They just barely make any good ones.
Yes.
You make a great adventure movie, frick, man, I'm on board. I'll sit down and watch Sahara. That movie makes no sense and I'll watch it. But they just don't make great ones. But when they do, there really is nothing better. There really is nothing better. And I think this was a perfect example of a replacement for Fellowship of the Ring, because Fellowship of the Ring is essentially this, but with nine, because nine is more, which no more is better. And Merry and Pippin really aren't part of it. So forget that. All right, John. Well, we are about to take a very long break. We both have life things that are about to take place. So we will not be back until the week of June 29th. That's the Wednesday of that week. So could be before then, could be after then. We haven't decided exactly what day we're going to start doing podcasts at this point. But we will be back on that week of June 29th. We're off for 4 weeks, though, so you got a lot of time. Watch a lot of movies if you have the time to do it. John and I will have like 2 weeks each where we have time to watch movies, but that's it. When we do come back, we're going to be getting into our top 35 of all time, and hopefully we can pound that out over the course of 35 straight weeks and get this thing done with. But are we talking about Ivan's Childhood from 1962 for John and WALL-E from 2008 for me? So we are into our top 35 of all time. Can't wait to get that going, but you're all going to have to wait just a little bit longer because we got to go do some life stuff, and we'll be back that week. A hard-earned break, John. We haven't had this long of a break since we started this thing 16 months ago.
Yeah.
So enjoy that. Thank you, everybody, for listening. Please be patient. We'll be back. You want to hear me talk about WALL-E. You definitely want to hear me talk about WALL-E. I love WALL-E. It's the best. And Ivan's Childhood, it's Russian, and John likes Russian things, so that'll be good too. And not for nothing, it's a long wait. Both of these movies are an hour and a half long. You're welcome. You're welcome. This is the week to hop back on the train. But that's it. We'll see you all next time.